Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. I'm going to give you three ticker symbols. You're going to guess the companies, all right? YHOO is one. That one's pretty easy. DOW is another. That one's a flat giveaway, y'all. DD is the third. Not so easy, right? Also not, by the way, Dunkin' Donuts. But therein, in those three companies, lies the story of a changing economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Wednesday, the 9th of December. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. The business and economy lead today is a story of three companies, two old and established and in some trouble, one quite a bit younger, sort of established, also, however, in some trouble. And that's where we're going to start. Yahoo announced this morning that its board of directors has changed the company's mind. They are not going to spin off their oh-so-valuable stake in the Chinese e-commerce giant Alibaba after all. That after a year or more of planning and saying they were going to do exactly that. The operative phrase in the press release this morning was concern, and this is a quote, about the market's perception of tax risk, end of quote. Seems like kind of a big decision to boil down to the tax code, but Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports that companies do it all the time.
Taxes determine how companies are born, how they grow, and how they die.
It begins at the beginning.
Steve Rosenthal is senior fellow at the Tax Policy Center.
With the choice of entity structure.
Start as a corporation, partnership, sole proprietorship, taxes make a big difference for which one you choose, not to mention where a company starts or moves to in the case of inversions.
In the current global economy, companies have a lot of choice.
Ryan Dudley is with accounting firm Friedman LLP. It's not just that the world is smaller, it's that the nature of a lot of businesses these days makes them more mobile and therefore more sensitive to the fact that different places have different tax rates.
The modern economy is much more driven by intangible property.
So like in a manufacturing economy, it's all about where do I put my factories? How close to my market? How close to my resources? And it's also hard to move a factory. Today's economy is much more about patents and software and IP. All you need to move those things to a low-tax country is an accountant and a lawyer. Stephen Bank teaches business law at UCLA.
It's the basis for a lot of Google and Microsoft and other tech companies transfer of all their intellectual property to Irish companies.
And, of course, taxes play into little things like mergers and acquisitions.
To take the most recent financial crisis and the bailout, Wells Fargo would not have acquired Wachovia Bank if the IRS hadn't issued a notice suspending their limits on the ability to use losses.
So, yeah, taxes. In unrelated news, Congress hasn't undertaken a major tax reform in almost 30 years. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
All right, I promised a tale of three companies today. Yahoo is one of them, a youngish enterprise that doesn't really make anything. Corporations numbers 2 and 3 have been around for a collective 300 years, making things all the while. The chemical and agricultural stalwarts Dow Chemical and DuPont, there, by the way, is ticker symbol DD. Those two are said to be on the verge of a merger, a big merger. Both companies are under pressure to ditch some of the older products they've been making for generations now and focus on newer, faster-growing businesses, which seems to make it fair game to ask this question. When did it become not okay to just make stuff and make money doing it, too? Marketplace's Scott Tong has that one.
DuPont no longer makes paint or Teflon. Dow is out of the business of Ziploc bags. Both face shareholder pressure to ditch their traditional slow-growing sectors and push into more money-making ventures like crop seeds and pesticides, and now to potentially tie up and restructure some more. Economist J.W. Mason is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute.
What's striking about both of them, even before this merger was announced, is how much money they were paying out to shareholders.
Shareholders, who Mason argues have exercised outsized influence in corporate America for 3 decades. Dow and DuPont have given stockholders $9 billion the last couple years. And Mason says they didn't do that in the past. In his view, the job of the stock market has flipped.
Finance was a tool for getting money into the corporate sector, but now overwhelmingly finance is a tool for getting money out of the corporate sector.
Money to shareholders is money not put into, say, research. And there's been a trend in this non-investment generally, says Richard Silla at the Stern School of Business at NYU.
Investment is one of the drivers of economic growth, but ever since the financial crisis, companies seem to be quite reluctant to make new investments, and that's partly responsible for our slow economic growth.
He says investor pressure is particularly acute for manufacturing firms like Dow and DuPont. They face global competition in a way American tech companies don't. Not surprisingly, the future for these old line chemical companies is higher tech products like genetically modified seeds and ditching their old DNA.
Nothing is forever. That's what business is about.
Charles Elson teaches corporate governance at the University of Delaware.
DuPont is not what it was 200 years ago. It was a gunpowder company. It moved from gunpowder to nylon, you know, and nylon to housing materials. Good businesses constantly innovate.
Perhaps with a nudge or more from shareholders. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, well, you know, there is a riff I could do here about how everybody's just waiting for the next week's Fed meeting on interest rates, but really, who knows what evil lurks in the heart of Wall Street, why they do what they do. Speaking of that Fed meeting, by the way, if conventional wisdom is to be believed, Dr. Yellen and company are going to raise the federal funds rate for the first time in a decade. A decade. So what do you want to know about what that means and why it matters? Do you even remember the last time the Fed raised rates? Let us know. We'll figure out the answer and maybe get you on the radio in the process. You can tweet at us. We're at Marketplace there, or you can hit us up on Facebook, Marketplace APM there. No, I haven't forgotten about Wall Street. Three down days in a row. If you're the type who keeps track, we'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a couple of days left in the UN Climate Conference over in Paris. There will be a communique or an announcement or a summary of some kind when the thing wraps up. Not getting much love over there, though, is something called cap and trade, the most market-based approach there is to cutting greenhouse gas emissions. It's languishing on the sidelines because, well, because of history, really. Europe launched the first major cap and trade system a decade ago, creating a market in pollution allowances that would give companies a financial incentive to do less polluting. Catch is that things didn't quite turn out as expected, as Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports from London.
So here's how cap and trade works. All across Europe, thousands of companies have had their greenhouse gas emissions capped. If they want to emit more, they have to buy special allowances or credits. If they cut their emissions, they can earn surplus credits, which they can then sell. Hence, carbon trading. It seemed like a great idea at the time to save the planet, hand the whole business over to the financial markets.
Still heard the 65 was last, that 50K.
The notion of carbon trading took hold in Europe in the late 1990s.
165, I've got a seller, 165 or 164 was it?
And that was no accident, says Charlie Cronick of Greenpeace. That was before the financial crash, when the free market reigned supreme.
There was a complete belief in the dominance of the marketplace. I think the belief was that markets could only do one thing, and that was succeed and lead to happiness, prosperity, and, you know, goodness all around.
Militant environmentalists on both sides of the pond vehemently opposed carbon trading from the outset. They said it would never work, and anyway, it was obscene for banks to profit from an ecological disaster.
These people just want to make money from it, and their PR people are promoting...
Well, 10 years after Europe launched the first big emissions trading scheme, the critics do seem to have been proved right, claims Charlie Cronick.
The idea that carbon trading would be somehow central to driving a low-carbon economy just turned out not to be true in Europe.
So what exactly went wrong? Well, the system depends on the credits or allowances fetching a decent price in the market. In other words, a high price for emitting carbon. But that's been the problem, says Damian Morris of the campaign group Sandbag.
The market experienced a fundamental crisis that led to a crash in the carbon price, a huge oversupply of allowances, and therefore the carbon price crashed.
Governments had issued too many allowances to their power stations and factories in order to protect them financially. And then the Great Recession led to lower energy use. The price of the allowances, the price of carbon, collapsed from 30 euros down at one point to less than 4 euros a ton. As the price of carbon fell, it meant it was cheaper to pollute.
Exactly right.
I'm 165, 164 without you now.
Okay. Even now, the carbon price in Europe is only 8 or 9 euros a ton, nothing like enough to persuade companies to invest further in clean energy. But some true believers are still keeping faith with the European carbon trading system.
It was the first of its type in the world, and there were some inevitable sort of teething troubles, as you get in any business sector.
Richard Folland runs a climate trade association. He says reforms are on the way. Eventually, there'll be a kind of central bank to intervene and hoover up allowances if they become too plentiful. Oh, and he says China is launching the biggest carbon market in the world.
Take those developments plus the calls from business and investors that they want to see more and more price for carbon adopted around the world. It looks like there's a fairly positive direction of travel now.
But the sceptics say Europe has shown that the planet cannot rely on the vagaries of carbon trading. They argue that now everything depends on governments pledging stricter and binding emissions targets, which they hope and pray will emerge this week from the climate change conference. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
This morning, the Supreme Court waded back into the issue of affirmative action in college admissions. The justices heard arguments in the case of a white student, Abigail Fisher is her name, who said she was denied admission to the University of Texas because of her race. Like a lot of selective colleges, UT does consider an applicant's race or ethnicity, among many factors, when deciding who gets in. If the Supreme Court says that's not okay, colleges are going to be looking for other ways to get diversity into their student bodies. So from the education desk at WYPR in Baltimore, Marketplace's Amy Scott takes a look at some of the possible workarounds.
It's widely accepted in higher education that diversity is a worthy goal. Attorney Charles Sims filed a friend of the court brief in the Fisher case on behalf of dozens of private colleges.
It's just vital to be able to allow the universities to select the students that they think together will make the most educationally interesting class for all the students who are there.
The question is how best to do that. Eight states have banned race-based affirmative action since the mid-1990s. Richard Collenberg is a fellow at the Century Foundation, a think tank. He says instead, schools have given preference to low-income students, offered more financial aid, and made it easier to transfer from community colleges to four-year universities.
The good news from my standpoint is that public officials did not give up on diversity. They found new ways to create it, and in some ways, better methods, given that they will benefit economically disadvantaged students of all races.
At the University of California at Berkeley, UCLA, and the University of Michigan, though, the percentages of Black, Latino, and Native American students plummeted after laws took effect banning race-based affirmative action. Collenberg says that's partly because those flagships compete with private universities that can consider race. And Andrew Grossman with the Cato Institute says the UC system has maintained diversity.
Minority admissions have actually increased, and even more importantly, minority graduation rates have gone up quite considerably.
Still, others say if colleges could no longer consider race at all, looking at income alone wouldn't cut it.
There is no way that class-based affirmative action could maintain the level of racial and ethnic diversity at selective institutions.
Sigal Alon is an associate professor at Tel Aviv University and wrote the book Race, Class, and Affirmative Action. She says class-based admissions policies do increase socioeconomic and geographic diversity, but if colleges want to give equal opportunity to students of color, their admissions policies have to consider race. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
I am sure that this is the most compelling case for Satoshi Nakamoto's identity ever published.
The person who created Bitcoin. Maybe. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial's off 75 points today, 0.4%, closed at 17,492. The Nasdaq also down 75 points, about 1.5% there. 5,022. The S&P 500 dropped 15 points, 0.75%, finished at 2,047. Chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont, as we were talking about, are going to merge, maybe, possibly, sort of. Dow Chemical advanced 11.9%. DuPont steamed up 11.8%. Got cheated out of that 10% somehow. I don't know. Tech firms took their lumps. Yahoo clicked down 1.3% today after its board, as we said, decided not to sell their stake in the Chinese e-commerce company Alibaba. Costco crumbled 5.4% on worse-than-expected results posted late yesterday. The wholesaler's same-store sales fell for a third straight quarter. I have to tell you, not at my Costco. It's always packed. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. So there you are with your freshly minted college degree or maybe a brand new MBA thinking about what you're going to do next when the $200 billion a year consulting industry comes a-calling. It's still a powerful draw for a whole lot of people, consulting is, despite a well-earned reputation for long hours and endless travel. But seeing as how graduates put work-life balance a bit higher on their priority lists now than they did back in the day, options beyond the big-name high-pressure firms are being created. Marketplace's Mark Garrison has that story.
We're standing in front of a sandwich shop in a Minneapolis office building. Most people look at it and think about what to order. Carlos Castellan has been consulting for a restaurant chain recently, so he sees questions and opportunities. He points out some things and walks me through the kind of questions a food industry client might hire him to figure out, like smartphone ordering.
That process of taking it through the whole kitchen system and then pushing it out to the point of sale.
He's got a Harvard MBA and professional experience at a big retailer, the type of candidate consulting firms go after. And they did, but he chose a different path.
It would be very tough for me to go to a big company at this point.
Big firms don't offer new consultants much choice on what projects they can work on. He wanted to focus on retail. And the near certainty of being on the road every Monday through Thursday was definitely a problem.
Having a family is very important to both my wife and me, so that travel element really is difficult to manage, as well as being supportive of your family.
So he became a freelance consultant. Lots of people leave consulting to start their own boutique firms, but typically that's after long careers. Castellan's not even a year out of business school, but he's in control of his own schedule and says he's making more money than a typical starting salary at a major firm. The story of how he's able to pull that off starts in another city, at a company where we dropped in on a recent staff meeting.
We're in a world now where each individual person on our team, if you land one of those relationships, you could have a truly transformational impact on the business. And
this is Boston, a city which is the cradle of consulting. Several of the biggest firms began here, and all of them flood campuses every year to recruit Harvard and MIT students in bulk. But this company is no consulting firm, though plenty of employees have experience.
I was a consultant. I was at the Evil Empire.
Pat Petiti is one of the founders of Hourly Nerd, a startup that connects businesses to freelance consultants and takes a cut of the fees. The idea is a space where companies that don't need big-ticket, seven-figure-plus consulting engagements can find experts to help them with small and medium-sized problems. For the consultants offering their services, like Carlos Castellan, it's a chance to have more control over their careers and their lives. Rob Biederman is another co-founder.
You know, a lot of folks on our platform are either parents or caring for their own parents.
It's proving popular with businesses and consultants, not to mention venture investors who have poured more than $11 million into Hourly Nerd. The ex-consultants working there sometimes talk about the industry the way Uber execs talk about the taxi business, bloated, inefficient, incumbent, all the startup swear words, but they're not really competing for the same projects.
Their model is so expensive that they can't be working on the $30,000 and $40,000 and $50,000 projects that we are, and so it's not necessarily all that attractive to them to pursue.
Biederman says some big-name consultants have even referred business to Hourly Nerd, projects too small for them to bother with. But Hourly Nerd does compete for consulting talent, with people like Keith Bevins, a partner at Bain & Company.
The people that are attracted to Bain & Company are looking to have an impact, and they're looking to be supported in their own personal development.
As leader of Bain's recruiting, he and his team make that pitch year after year. MBA students at elite schools are prepping hard right now and all through the holidays for high-stakes interviews that'll determine whether they get coveted summer internships at Bain. When they ask Bevins about long hours and travel, he's clear there will be some of that. But he argues it's part of a bigger overall experience that works, and he has data.
Every other month, every case team gets surveyed on a couple of different metrics to understand how satisfied are they, how much of an impact are they having, do they feel like they're learning, do they feel like they're developing. And time again, what we see is that that doesn't correlate with hours and it doesn't correlate with travel.
That may sound like a slick sales pitch from a 20-year Baniac, and it is, but there are independent data. In Glassdoor's latest report on the best U.S. companies to work for, Bain comes in second, beating out Google, Facebook, and Apple. With on-demand consulting increasingly an option, people with analytical minds and a taste for problem-solving may not have to sign up with a big consulting firm if they don't want the travel. And those who do can still go to work for places like Bain. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Police raided a home in suburban Sydney, Australia this afternoon. It's mere coincidence, they say, that the homeowner, a guy by the name of Craig Wright, was named in a pair of prominent tech publications as probably, they're pretty sure, the creator of Bitcoin. The qualifiers are because we have yet to find out who the near legendary and pseudonymous founder of the cryptocurrency, Satoshi Nakamoto, he goes by. We have yet to find out who he really is. Sam Biddle co-wrote the story for Gizmodo. Sam, it's good to have you on.
Thank you for having me.
How sure are you, after all the forensics that you guys have done, how sure are you that Craig Wright is Satoshi Nakamoto?
I am sure that this is the most compelling case for Satoshi Nakamoto's identity ever published.
Ever. There have been others. I mean, Newsweek had a big thing in the New York Times. I mean, you know.
There have been others. And the other ones have been, you know, varying from very good to minorly disastrous. Mm-hmm. I think that ours has the most evidence. That said, I do not claim to have this nailed 100%. We're talking about a mythical persona.
Why does it matter that we find out who Satoshi Nakamoto actually is?
Because we all want to know. It's natural to pursue any great mystery, especially when it's the identity of someone who in any other world would have stepped forward years ago to accept the universal mm-hmm. praise and awards and generous speaking gigs that this would come with. You know, whatever you think of Bitcoin, be it, you know, that it's trivial or that it's brilliant in the future, it is an incredible piece of software. And whoever made it, or whichever people made it, would be heroes in the field. And so it's bizarre that they would remain completely anonymous. That's never happened before. I mean, you know, Mark Zuckerberg goes to the fanciest parties in the world because he created Facebook.
One of the things, one of the matching data points, I guess, that exists between Craig Wright and Satoshi Nakamoto is a huge stash of Bitcoin, apparently, that are sitting there in a trust, and it's a long, convoluted story, but it's a million Bitcoin, which today is like $410 million something worth. So there's huge amounts of money involved here.
That's right. If everything that we've looked at is accurate, he is an exceedingly wealthy man, only he is completely untouched and untapped. He would be sitting on, you know, the price of Bitcoin fluctuates, but sometimes it's as high as $500 million, sometimes, you know, maybe $300 million, but still a lot of dollars. And it's always been speculated that Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever he or she is sitting on a sum of that size.
It is not without possibility, you write, that Craig Wright has doctored things, shall we say, to make it appear that he is the founder of Bitcoin when maybe he wasn't.
Sure. We are dealing with digital evidence here, which is easier to doctor than anything else. We corroborated this evidence with people around the world, from Florida to the suburbs of Sydney, which makes me feel confident about it. That said, there is certainly the possibility that this is an extremely, exceedingly elaborate con. If it is a con perpetrated by Craig Wright, there are so many people in on it, and it has spanned so many years and locales that, to me, that would be more impressive than creating Bitcoin.
Are you among those who believe that Bitcoin is the wave of the financial future, that it could just render the global financial system obsolete as soon as we figure out how to deal with this thing?
I don't think that Bitcoin in its current form is the future. Maybe some form of digital currency could be the future someday. I mean, I wouldn't rule that out. But the ability of this open source software to bring the big banks and Western Union to their knees has, I think it's safe to say, not panned out. There was always an element of sci-fi William Gibson dreaming in the Bitcoin story, that people would throw down their credit cards and start using QR codes instead. And that hasn't come to pass. It's still, although it is used by millions of people around the world, it's not a failure. It is still very much a niche, and people are still using their credit cards and cash.
Yes, we are. Do you have any Bitcoin, by the way?
I do not. Both because it would be a conflict of interest and because I do not, you can only spend it in like two places.
Sam Biddle is a reporter for Gizmodo. The piece is about maybe the guy who is Satoshi Nakamoto, the guy who founded Bitcoin. Sam, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
To see all of those details, and there are a whole bunch of them, screenshots of emails and transcripts and the like, we've got a link to the Gizmodo piece at our website, about which, by the way, we've got a new beta version of our website we would love for you to check out. Give it a whirl. Send us your thoughts, good, bad, or otherwise. Be gentle, please. beta.marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, the Genesee Brewing Company up in Rochester, New York, has really captured, I believe, the message of the holidays. They have built a Christmas tree, a really big one, out of beer kegs. 428 of them, stands 26 feet high. The thing does, that is 11 layers worth of kegs, bottom to top. Only bad part is that they're empty, but, you know, safety first, I guess. Oh my goodness, look at the time, got to go. The Dow off 75 points today, 0.4%. The NASDAQ also down 75, 1.5%. The S&P 500 dropped 15 points, 0.75%. Chris Clark, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Garrett Lang, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, and Charlton Thorpe engineer the broadcast for us. You know who I am, and this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.